Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the state of lung cancer. A new report reveals New York is among the best in the nation for early diagnosis, surgery, and survival. We'll learn more from the American Lung Association about opportunities for the state to further improve lung cancer survival. The region's under a winter storm warning, but despite the wet weather, there's still a drought warning in effect, and New York City paused the $2 billion aqueduct repair project, citing the drought. We'll learn more about what it means for the Delaware River watershed. The Agro Legacy Program of the Wayne Tomorrow is certifying food and agricultural products grown in Wayne County. We'll learn more about that, and the new reading at NACL Sweet Look. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, accusing them of war crimes. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports.
In a unanimous decision, the court's judges rejected appeals by Israel about jurisdiction and went forward with issuing arrest warrants for Netanyahu, former defense minister Yoav Gallant, and for Hamas leader Mohammed Deif, even though Israel says they killed Deif in a missile attack. The court said Netanyahu and Gallant bear criminal responsibility for using starvation as a method of war, as well as for murder and directing attacks against civilians. The warrants mean the court's more than 120 member states would be obliged to arrest Netanyahu and Gallant if they entered their territory. Israel's Office of the Prime Minister responded by saying the decision was, quote, anti-Semitic and made by a corrupt prosecutor. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Ukraine claims that Russia has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile into one of its major cities in central Ukraine. If confirmed, this would be the first time in this war Russia has fired an ICBM. The Kremlin hasn't commented. The missile attack comes as Ukraine has used U.S.-made long-range missiles to fire deep into Russian territory. Forecasters in the U.S. say an atmospheric river is pouring up to a foot of rain on some parts of Northern California. Higher elevations are under a winter storm warning. The same system hit farther north this week. Strong winds left two people dead in Washington State, where more than 325,000 customers still don't have power. Allison Giannini lives east of Seattle, where a tree fell on her carport.
I was just really worried that the rest of the carport would come down, or maybe even take the beams down, and then that would be the end of us, but we made it through.
She spoke to KOMO-TV. The National Weather Service warns a second powerful storm system will hit the Pacific Northwest starting tomorrow. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the National Association of Realtors reports an uptick in home sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials rose about 40 points in early trading.
October home sales were up 2.9% from a year ago. That's the first year-over-year increase in more than 3 years. The number of homes on the market also rose last month. The average selling price climbed to just over $407,000. Strong demand for computer chips that power artificial intelligence produced another blockbuster quarter for NVIDIA. The chip designer's quarterly sales were nearly double what they were a year ago, and quarterly profits jumped to more than $19 billion. The Justice Department wants Google to sell its popular web browser, Chrome, and stop paying other companies to make Google their default search option. The petition comes after a federal court found Google had abused its monopoly power. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In Alaska, Republican Nick Begich III has won the state's only congressional seat. He defeated incumbent Democrat Mary Peltola. Alaska voters also decided to keep the state's method of ranked choice voting. There's word from India that a 3-year-old boy has become the country's youngest ranked chess player in history. Amkar Kandekar has more.
Anish Sarkar has to occasionally stand on his chair during tournaments to move his pieces on the chessboard. But earlier this month, the 3-year-old from Kolkata became the youngest player to get ranked by the World Chess Federation. Sarkar scored 5.5 points when he needed only half a point against senior players to qualify for an official ranking. His mother, Reema Sarkar, told a local newspaper that he trains under a professional coach and YouTube. India has a vibrant chess culture, which has produced several teen prodigies in the recent years, including the youngest ever challenger at the World Championship to be held later this month. For NPR News, I'm Omkar Khandekar in Mumbai.
The Country Music Association presented its awards last night. Nashville Public Radio's Julie Height says Chris Stapleton picked up 4 awards.
He took home more trophies, male vocalist, song, and single, than anyone else, because he is beloved as a durable and reliable superstar that really doesn't vary that much in style or quality. If you want a cowboy, white
hole, Julie Hyde reporting. The CMA's Entertainer of the Year was Morgan Wallen. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Catskills and higher elevations might see more than 10 inches of snow tonight and tomorrow. We'll have more on the winter storm warning in a few minutes. But first, lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer deaths here in New York and across the United States. But the American Lung Association's 2024 State of Lung Cancer Report reveals some positive news. The lung cancer survival rate has improved 26% in the last 5 years. The report also presents opportunities for New York to further improve lung cancer survival by increasing access to screening and biomarker testing. Mike Seelback is the Assistant Vice President for Public Policy for the American Lung Association, and he joins us now with more. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being here. And as I mentioned, lung cancer, the leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States and in New York. But the State of Lung Cancer report shows that 26% improvement in lung cancer survival rates in the state. What do you think has driven that in the past 5 years?
You know, there really has been a lot of advances when it comes to lung cancer over recent years. One, we have lung cancer screening. So there is screening available now for high-risk individuals that it's a scan, a CT scan of the lungs. And so we are finding that cancer is being found earlier. And when, like all cancers, when it's found early, there's much better prognosis and much better treatment options. The question that we often hear is, well, who's eligible for screening? And basically, if you are between the ages of 50 and 80 years old, and you have what's considered a 20-pack year history of smoking, what does that mean? If you smoked a pack a day for 20 years, or half a pack a day, you know, basically there's. But if you are a smoker for a pretty considerable part of your life, and you're between the ages of 50 and 80, you should talk to your doctor and see if screening might be an option for you. But it's not just screening. There is actually a lot of treatments now for lung cancer. There are, you know, so obviously there's chemotherapy, there is surgery, but then there are also different kinds of medications that are targeted towards different genetic mutations and other things that make up the cancer, that these treatments are really extending life in a major way.
New York ranks highly in the report for early diagnosis, surgery, and survival rates, but there's still some disparities and challenges. The report found that African American individuals in New York State are less likely to be diagnosed early. Why do you think this disparity exists, and how can we address it?
You know, unfortunately, this is a disparity that we see for many different health outcomes. We know that Black individuals in New York not only are less likely to be diagnosed early, but many health outcomes are lagging. And there's a multitude of reasons for that. We know that there is sort of a institutional, long-term, biases that present themselves. We know that there, when it comes to lung cancer, there's stigma for, you know, when you talk about lung cancer, oftentimes there is a reticence. you know, people kind of talk quietly. They say, oh, he has lung cancer. And we're trying to bring that out of the shadows. The fact is, if you have lungs, you can get lung cancer. And getting lung cancer today is very different than what it was 20 years ago. And people could live long, vibrant lives. So we want to make sure that health providers in all communities, but especially in communities of color, that they are talking to their patients or making sure that they understand that there are screening available.
Screening rates improved, but under 20% of those high-risk individuals in New York are screened. Do you think that that stigma you mentioned is one of the main barriers to lung cancer screening, and how could that be overcome?
You know, talking about it right here is sort of the first step. We know that there is because it is a newer screening tool, people are less aware about it. And then, as you mentioned, stigma is a part of it. But we are trying to change that. And, you know, we have tools on our website, something called Save by the Scan, where you can go on and basically answer this little quiz that says you may be eligible for screening. And we've had, you know, literally millions of people go onto our website, and some have been saved literally by taking this quiz and then finding out that they were eligible and getting treated for cancer in a very early stage.
Let's talk about biomarker testing. Comprehensive biomarker testing is a crucial part of personalized treatment. Why is that so important? And has insurance or insurers, have they in New York, have they helped patients access this testing?
Yeah, so not all cancers are exactly the same. So when we talk about lung cancer, it means there is a cancer in your lungs. But what science has been able to figure out now is that there are literally in the tumor's DNA differences. And there are currently 11 different biomarkers for lung cancer. And each of them have different treatments, different medications that are targeted for that specific type of cancer. And New York in recent years mandated that insurance cover comprehensive biomarker testing. And so basically what this means for an individual is you perhaps get scanned, you find there is a tumor or a nodule, and you can ask your provider to do biomarker testing. And it takes about 2 weeks. So we know that that is a very anxiety, stress given time. But the facts are that when you do this biomarker testing, you potentially are going to have better treatment options. And so those 2 weeks in the beginning could really lead to a much better outcome for your life.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Mike Seelback, Assistant Vice President for Public Policy for the American Lung Association, about the 2024 State of Lung Cancer Report in New York, revealing some positive news. But you're also advocating for the passage of the Increasing Access to Lung Cancer Screening Act. I hope I have that right, in New York.
That's right.
Can you explain why this legislation is so important for continuing to improve these lung cancer outcomes?
So there are a couple of different things that we're advocating for. As you mentioned, in Congress, we're trying to push something called the Increasing Access to Lung Cancer Screening Act, and that would really provide screening, you know, more opportunity, more coverage across the nation. Here in New York, you know, we have very good policies, which is great. We're sort of ahead of the curve in many ways and compared to many states. But there are a couple of bills that would bring lung cancer screening for individuals that are eligible on par to coverage for things like colorectal, breast, and cervical cancer. Again, what does that mean? Basically, after you get screened, we want to make sure that all those follow-up appointments with doctors are also covered. And that currently exists for those other cancers, But it varies when it comes to lung cancer, and we want to make sure that those are on par.
And looking ahead, what do you believe are the most pressing priorities for improving lung cancer prevention, diagnosis, treatment in New York over the next few years?
You know, we need to keep bringing lung cancer out of the shadows. We need to be talking about it. We need to make sure that there is coverage. We need to make sure that research continues. Funding research is so important in finding treatments that are going to extend life. And we want to make sure that individuals that are at high risk are talking to their doctors and getting screened. And we want to continue pushing forward on reducing those risk factors. You mentioned, tobacco use. We know that that is the major cause, but it's not the only cause. There's radon, which is an invisible gas that occurs naturally, and it comes up from underground. And there are simple, cheap tests that you could pick up at your local hardware store to make sure that radon levels in your home are not high. But if they are high, there is mitigation that is pretty cheap, which would vent that gas out of your home. That helps reduce exposure. And then it's really continuing on the work on decreasing air pollution, which is another major factor for lung cancer, whether we're talking about cars and truck pollution or even things like wildfire smoke, which unfortunately we're seeing more and more of on the East Coast. So it's really reducing all those different exposures and making sure that folks that are at high risk are getting screened.
And we've been focusing on New York, but this is a state of lung cancer across the United States. Pennsylvania, in our listening area, nationally, the lung cancer survival rate improved 26% in the last 5 years and 27% in Pennsylvania. You guys have a breakdown of all of the state data at your website, lung.org, for the State of Cancer Report. Before we go, for people at high risk of lung cancer who haven't been screened yet or still maybe be worried about that stigma, what message would you want to share with them today?
You know, as someone, my family was touched by lung cancer, and I completely understand it's scary. And I think it's scary for any of us to have to go for any kind of testing. But the fear in not getting tested, you know, doesn't at all reduce the risk. And so, like all cancers, early detection saves lives. And, you know, have the conversation. That's the starting point, right? Talking to your physician or your healthcare provider and seeing if this is something that they might recommend. And if it is, we recommend getting that screen. And it's for all cancers, right? Making sure that there's not something already developing inside you that can be treated. The fact is that when it comes to cancer, time is not something that we want to wait on, because the earlier that cancer is found, the more treatment is available. So have that conversation. That's the first step.
You mentioned the lung cancer touched your family, and if you don't mind me asking, is that what's partially motivating you in your work with the American Lung Association?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was a young teenager, my grandfather was diagnosed with lung cancer at 62 years old, and he died within a year. And it was something that obviously had a profound effect on me. And as I then graduated college and was sort of looking for a job in my career search, I sort of landed at the American Lung Association, and it really has sort of spurred my work and my desire, and the fact that we are now seeing people living, you know, decades after diagnosis is really gratifying. And I want to make sure that there are more and more survivors out there so that, you know, no one has to go through what I went through.
Yeah. Again, the American Lung Association's State of Lung Cancer Report is out now. You can access it at lung.org and also access other ways to get involved, treatment, and call the Lung Helpline as well. It's Awareness Month, Lung Cancer Awareness Month in November. We've been speaking to Mike Seelback, the Assistant Vice President of Public Policy for the American Lung Association. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for talking. We appreciate it.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, New York City has paused repairs on the Delaware Aqueduct. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, a conversation with Mexican actors Diego Luna and Gael Garcia Bernal.
I know friendship. I know what that is. But what I have with Gael is something else. What we have is called more like the your chosen family.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to wjffradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning for our region, if you haven't heard by now. It goes into effect at 4 today and goes through 4 tomorrow. Most of us could see 4 to 6 inches of snowfall after this rain transitions to snow, mainly overnight and into tomorrow morning. Though those living in our northernmost and higher elevation areas could get 9 inches or more, and totals of 12 to 18 inches possible in the highest elevations in western Wayne, eastern Lackawanna, Delaware, and eastern Susquehanna counties. It's already impacting some schools. The Liberty Central School District has canceled after-school activities today. We'll keep you posted on any other closings. Despite this precipitation, severe drought conditions across the Delaware River watershed have caused widespread concerns throughout the entire river valley. This week, Governor Kathy Hochul issued a drought warning for the Hudson Valley and the Catskills, and New York City issued a drought warning of their own and halted a long-anticipated project to repair the Delaware Aqueduct. The aqueduct, which transports water from the Delaware River to New York City, supplying the city with half its daily supply of drinking water, have been closed for repairs since October 1st. The drought warning declaration means the city will postpone its project to repair the Delaware Aqueduct for the third year in a row. Jason Dole spoke to Roger Hannigan Gilson of the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau yesterday for more.
Essentially, this has been in the works for 20 years. What the project aims to do is reroute the Delaware Aqueduct, which supplies 50% of New York City and a bunch of communities in the Hudson Valley with water around this giant leak that's actually under the Hudson River and the town of Newburgh. It jettisons like 30 million gallons a day. So essentially this bypass has been built. It was completed in 2021, but it took quite some time to build. And the leak was actually discovered in the late 1990s. So they've been trying to address it since then, and the plan's been in the works, the research, the studies since the early 2000s. So it's this giant project. Over the course of its entire history, it's about $2 billion. Kind of sub projects they had to complete to get this running. And then, yeah, you're right, it was put off twice. Not for weather reasons, but it was supposed to originally start October 1st, 2022, then October 1st, 2023, and then it started this year. But it's being pulled back upon right now.
And, you know, this is all related to the really crazy long dry spell that we've had that have led to actual drought conditions in the Hudson Valley as well as the Catskills and as well as in the New York City area, which basically is the whole chain of where the water is coming from and where it's going to. So Mayor Adams at the front of this and the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP that oversees the reservoirs in our area, they're basically pausing us because of the drought, right?
Yeah, they are. You know, the part of this whole plan is that, you know, the DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, which is the New York City agency, which is in charge of the aqueducts and the reservoirs, they knew that the project couldn't be pulled off if it was too dry. And essentially they said, in 80% of years, like, it could be pulled off. There was enough water, but then there's that 20% when it couldn't. And so they were using climate models by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and by Columbia University to try to predict whether there would be a drought or not. And none of them did. Some of the climate models suggested it'd be wetter than usual, right around now. So, you know, it's an imperfect system, climate modeling. It's such a complicated system, the climate, and, you know, the models just got it wrong.
And, you know, it's further irony to all this is, as I understand it, the delay, at least last year, was because they still wanted to look at the impacts on local streams and make sure that they were got all the information they could have about this, because the concern was you didn't want to contribute to localized potential flooding while they're doing these works on the reservoirs, because the water's not all going down the line at that point because repairs are being made. This is almost the exact opposite problem. And I'm just wondering what, you know, I could understand why things being too wet would have been a problem for us locally. Why is it being too dry? Why is that a problem? Why does it need to be paused because of the drought?
Well, essentially, there are two aqueducts that run from the Catskill reservoirs. There's the Delaware aqueduct, which is the one that was shut off, and the Catskill aqueduct. So with the Delaware aqueduct not delivering water, the Catskill aqueduct has to, you know, go double time, essentially. There's a third set of reservoirs in Westchester and Putnam County that, you know, and it's also been very dry there. So essentially, you know, they overfilled, not overfilled like they were spilling out, but they filled the reservoirs connected to the Catskill aqueduct up extra full because they knew they would have to be using so much water from those reservoirs while the Delaware aqueduct was offline. So the whole system was working with like two-thirds of the reservoirs that they would normally. So there was just extra strain on those systems. So not having enough water coming into those reservoirs caused like an issue that caused, you know, Mayor Adams to try to conserve water with the drought watch, which has now been upgraded. And it also had impact in some Hudson Valley towns. About 70 communities in the Hudson Valley are served by the reservoir system. It's about 1 million people, most of them in Westchester. And, you know, they face problem A or problem B. Problem A being, you know, the Delaware aqueduct being shut down. So they had to rely more on local water sources, which, of course, were depleted themselves. And then if they were on the Catskill aqueduct, they were dependent on these reservoirs, which weren't getting any water because of the rainfall and was working double time to make up for the Delaware aqueduct being offline.
Yeah, and your article mentions communities in Orange County and Ulster County that get water from the reservoirs that I didn't even realize was the case. Could you just let us know what those communities are quick?
Yeah, I was actually unable to get a full listing of the 70, but New Windsor, town of Newburgh in Orange County, relies on the aqueduct system. In Ulster County, Marlborough does. The village of New Paltz does. Rosendale does. And then if you go down to Westchester, it's just many, many communities.
Right. And of course, New Windsor, you know, that's the area there where they've been battling that big Jennings Creek fire near Greenwood Lake and right on the border with New Jersey. You know, that's right there in that area. So that kind of brings it all full circle in terms of the dry conditions, the drought conditions, and the need for water.
Yeah, we definitely need some water. Thankfully, the forecast is looking, particularly cloudy. So, you know, at least I saw there might be a couple of inches of rain coming. But, you know, if one were to base our trust in weather predictions on the climate models that failed, like, who knows?
Now, are they giving any indication of how long this pause will last? Like, does this throw off the window of repairs altogether? Is this an indefinite pause? Like, what does this mean for the timeline of the project, and when could it possibly resume again?
Well, yeah, they have it set up. Essentially, what's going to happen is like how it happened in the 2 years it was put off before. They're going to have to pause for an entire year and then resume stuff October 1st, 2025. I couldn't get it out of them exactly how much they had done at this point, but if you just look at the timeline, they expected the Delaware Aqueduct to be offline for 8 months. You know, we're only a month and a half of it, so it's fair to say that the majority of work is to be done.
Wow. And that was exactly what I was wondering. Do they have to wait until next season, essentially, to start the whole slate of repairs again? And it sounds like that's what has to happen. And then,
yeah, that is what has to happen, because they essentially have many months of preparations each time. Like, they have to, as I was saying, they have to fill the the reservoirs connected to the Catskill Aqueduct up extra high. And, you know, that can only be accomplished in the spring when there's snow melt and extra precipitation that allows them to be filled that much. So, you know, they've gotten a bit done, but they're going to have to wait till next year to continue.
All right, Roger, is there anything else about this story that we didn't get to you want folks to know?
Well, yeah, I mean, just something I learned today. The DEP said it would take 1 to 9 weeks to get the Delaware Aqueduct back up and running. I heard this morning it should be 28 to 32 days because, you know, they have to pack up and everything. So, you know, things will be running normally in about a month's time.
Okay, well, the article is up now at timesunion.com, and we've been talking to Times Union Hudson Valley reporter Roger Hannigan-Gilson. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, thank you.
And since we've been on the air, we told you about that winter storm warning. After-school activities at Liberty Central School District, including the Boys and Girls Club, canceled. And since we've been on, all Fallsburg Central School District after-school activities, including Kids Club Child Care, are canceled for today due to the impending winter storm. We'll keep you posted. Stay with us. And stay with us. When we come back, we have Agro Legacy in Wayne County. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejayville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving 4 counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, pairing up strangers to have conversations, not debates. Remind the country of the humanity in all of us. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Agro Legacy Program of the Wayne Tomorrow Agricultural Task Force certifies food and agricultural products grown or raised on farms in Wayne County, Pennsylvania. Zachary Jones is the co-chair of Wayne Tomorrow's Ag Task Force and sustainable agricultural specialist for the Wayne County Conservation District. He's here to tell us more about Wayne Tomorrow's Agro Legacy brand. Zachary Jones, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so explain a little bit more about what the agricultural or agro legacy brand is, because agriculture in Wayne County is such a vital part of the community. How does it help support local farmers and agricultural businesses?
Yeah, so it's designed to benefit, you know, farmers and consumers so that everybody knows that they're buying something that's certified local, that was grown locally, produced by that farm and or business, or a business that buys from local farms, so that they know when they see that label that what they're buying is something truly local to them.
So it's a label, there's a brand. And so what ways do local markets or processors or restaurants contribute to promoting these local products? So they put that branding on their items, I guess.
Yeah, so if they sign up, they have to go through a process that certifies that what they produce and or are selling is local product. They go through the process of filling out an application. You know, we go out there, we certify it, and once we certify it, then they are listed as an agro-legacy, either producer, processor, or distributor slash retailer. And once they're registered, they can use that trademark logo. They can promote themselves as an agro-legacy business and really promote themselves with that.
What was the origin of the Agro Legacy program in Wayne County?
So the origin was we got a grant to do a brand for dairy and pairing that was kind of stretched out to get something that was designed for all encompassing of ag. It was part of our study we did in 2019, the ag feasibility study that pointed out some things that we can do to help drive economic viability of agriculture in Wayne County. And one of them was a brand to brand the agricultural products in Wayne County. So we came up with this Agri Legacy brand in conjunction with Mickey Jones Agency, who did the design work and did whole scope of work for the brand itself, so that we could promote local farms here in Wayne County to the best of our ability.
And can you tell us more about some of the other work that you're doing, the upcoming Agricultural Innovation Center you guys are working on? How is that going to help small farms and businesses in the area?
Yeah, so basically think about it as a brick-and-mortar building that is going to allow farmers to, if they are interested in creating a value-added business as a startup, a incubator, to say that they can start their food processing or product processing, whatever it may be, in this community kitchen, that they can create products, it's in a safe environment, and then they can ship it out to sell it or sell local, so that they have an entranceway or doorway to be able to start a value-added processing business.
And what's the timeline for that look like?
That's a good question. We're still in the planning phase on that. There's a lot of work that needs to be done yet, but a lot of work has gone into it already. Our CFO here at the county has secured some grants to start construction and planning on that. We're just waiting on some different permits and some more paperwork to go through before anything actually starts.
I mentioned you're the co-chair of Wayne Tomorrow's Ag Task Force. You are the sustainable agriculture specialist for the Wayne County Conservation District. How, I mean, you have to have seen how farming has changed, and how are local farmers incorporating best practices and new technologies into farming in the area?
Yeah, so if you think about what farming was even 20 years ago, a good majority of the agriculture here in Wayne County was still dairy farms, but the volatility of that industry has changed and reduced the numbers down to, you know, just a handful of dairy farmers left. So farmers had the option to either sell out and quit or sell their cows and try something different. A lot of people have moved to beef cows. Some have moved to diversifying further and growing vegetables, different aspects like that, in ways that they can, you know, still be a viable farm to make money but not rely on the dairy industry.
And despite these changes, farming has, you know, obviously really shaped the rural character of the area. It's very special to local residents. What about young people? Are there educational opportunities being provided to young people in the region to spark a continued interest in agriculture and keep them down on the farm, so to speak?
Yeah, so I mean, there's the FFA here at Holmesville High School. That is a good start for kids to get excited about ag, to learn more about ag. You know, as far as outside of high school, you know, the agriculture education really is going to come down to working on a farm, being a friend with a farmer, or finding an apprenticeship somewhere or something like that, so that you can learn how to farm. One of the things that we're working on, Wayne, tomorrow is just a way that we can bring people together, experienced farmers, new farmers, or people who want to be farmers, so that they can all sit around, talk, get ideas, and kind of collaborate to figure out, you know, here's what I did that worked, here's what I did that didn't work, and ways that we can help support and promote new farmers getting started.
So if farmers in the area want to join this Agro Legacy Program, who's eligible?
So you have to have your product raised, grown, produced in Wayne County. There's different stipulations depending on, you know, it doesn't have to be, if it's an animal, it doesn't have to be born in the county, but it has to be raised here in the county. There's different applications that you can set up for depending on what you're doing. If you're a farmer or if you're a value-added processor or a retailer, basically whatever you produce, if you're a farmer, needs to be grown here, raised here in Wayne County. If you're a food processor, whatever you are accumulating for your product needs to be here, raised in Wayne County and part of the Agro Legacy brand. Also, if you're a retailer, all three of those things need to happen here in the county.
Are there costs involved for folks who participate?
Nope. It's free entry.
And then there's a form to sign up at waynetomorrow.com and also at agrolegacy.org. You've outlined some of the benefits of how it helps folks. Also touched on a little bit about Wayne Tomorrow and your role in ensuring the sustainable future for agriculture in the region. Is there like an ultimate vision for Wayne County moving forward, of strategic planning for the next 5, 10, 20 years?
Yeah, so part of that feasibility study that we conducted in 2019 really kind of outlined the next 5 to 10 years of how we can support ag in our county, but also the changing demographics of agriculture in our county. Obviously, we have a significant age of farmers that is getting higher and higher every year, and trying to attract young and beginning farmers, you know, we have to think about what's going to be feasible. So the idea of farming in Wayne County 20 years ago was milking cows on 150, 200 acres. You know, that might change now to, you know, growing vegetables in your yard on a quarter acre, or in a greenhouse or a high tunnel on an acre or two, and, you know, creating a pretty sustainable living for your family.
That's Zachary Jones, co-chair of Wayne Tomorrow's Ag Task Force and Sustainable Agriculture Specialist for Wayne County's Conservation District. We've been talking about Wayne Tomorrow's Agro Legacy brand. More information at waynetomorrow.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yep, thank you.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, a reading of a new play in development at NACL. We'll learn more after this break. It's Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill's big annual music sale is almost here. Next Saturday, November 30th, 10 to 3 at the Liberty Mall in Liberty. Come get vinyl records, cassettes, CDs, the devices that play them, musical instruments, and more. And we're still accepting donations of records in good condition. And if you can't wait till next Saturday, we've got musical things that you can buy now. Radio Catskill's online music auction is live now at WJFFradio.org. And our big annual music sale is Saturday, November 30th in Liberty.
Hey there, I'm Cassie of Rare Pair Radio. It's a weekly showcase of primarily female artists, but also a wide range of avant-garde musicians. I will be playing the fruit of post-punk, experimental, and fringe music, only on WJFF Radio Catskill. Rare Pair Radio, Friday at 8 p.m.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Camille Thomas is a playwright and artist whose work powerfully explores themes of cultural legacies, ancestral wisdom, and the resilience of Black femmes in the face of oppression. Camille is currently a JAC partnership artist, and as part of her residency at NACL, she's developing Sweet Blood, a compelling new play that delves into the lives of three Black Maroon Taino women in Jamaica in 1727. The play explores their fight for survival as they face the encroaching forces of colonialism just before the onset of chattel slavery. Tomorrow, Camille and her collaborators will be reading selected scenes from the work in progress, along with audience discussion of the major themes. Camille is here now, along with Brett Kaiser from NACL. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you guys for coming in. Camille, the premise of Sweet Blood, as I mentioned, is rooted in the struggles of these three women in Jamaica in 1727. What drew you to these particular characters at this moment in history?
Yeah, so I am Jamaican and African American, and in Jamaica, my grandfather has this home. He had a home in Arntley, Jamaica. And we since have lost the home, but I was really interested in this house. It's my dream to buy it back and turn it into a residency for Jamaican artists. So I was researching the history of this home, and I found out that it used to be a coffee plantation. So I was wondering who might have worked on this plantation, who might have lived here. And so that was really the genesis of the story, and it expanded from there.
And the play explores survival, resistance, the impact of colonialism. How do you think the themes shape the choices of your characters, and what do you hope audiences take away from it at NACL?
Yeah, I hope audiences take away how detrimental colonialism has been to a lot of the Caribbean and imperialism. The characters are shaped by the lack of choices that they have and how small their world is getting as these forces get closer and closer and require them to make more and more difficult decisions. That they would not have had to make if it weren't for the sugar revolution and all of the things that were happening in Jamaica during this time.
You blend text and song and movement in the piece. Can you talk a little bit about how using these three different elements to tell the story help, and maybe what are the challenges you've encountered in combining them?
Yeah, challenges. I'm not a musician. I'm not. I can't sing. But I just heard that this story had song and rhythm in it because my people are so musical inherently. Jamaica being the home of reggae. Like, there is so much music, even in the language, that I was like, there's no way that I can't have the soul there in that way. But just trying to talk to my artists who are amazing singers, and I'm like, yeah, it sounds something like a doot doot da dee da da boo boo bow. And they're like, okay, sure, we can try that. And then they do it amazingly. And I'm like, okay, cool, we got this.
You were drawn to it naturally, knowing that it had to be part of it.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
How do the characters in Sweet Blood, how are they revolutionary to you?
We had such a good conversation about revolution. So I'm looking at my director, who's not, you know, here on the mic.
Racine Singletary is off camera here.
I think they are revolutionary in their care for each other, even in the face of such intense oppression and subjugation, the way that they still reach towards love and use that as their guiding light for what they are willing to do to protect their family, to protect their community, is really revolutionary to me.
Brett, I mentioned in the introduction that this is part of a partnership with JAC.
Yes.
It's one of the New York City partner theaters. Can you tell us a little bit more about that partnership?
Yeah, there are a number of New York City theaters that we do partnerships with, which allows artists that are being produced at those theaters, in this case, JAC, which is in Brooklyn,
yes,
to come and use the time and the space that NACL provides for artists to be able to just solely focus on their work, which we understand from artists is a really beautiful thing to be able to do, to not have to worry about anything else in your life, like where your next, you know, making lunch or dinner or anything like that. They're just working all the time. Maybe Camille can speak to what the experience is like.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what is that like, having that partnership and that backing.
Wonderful. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Layla, she's our chef. She's so good. And then I like being out of New York because I can see the stars. So it's really just simple things that just alleviate so much stress in the hustle and bustle in New York.
You'll get to see a lot of snow soon too. So as a partnership artist with Jack and also as an NACL artist in residency, how has that space changed or deepened your approach to this work?
I think just the time to be able to talk with my actors. I feel like in New York, because it is such a hustle bustle, go, 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 what's next, what's next? It's hard to dive deep into the text and the analysis and who these characters are. Right now, the show is probably running at 90 minutes with an intermission, but I think this could be a 2-hour production. Like, we're talking so many things about characters and who these people are and what their origin stories are that I really want to expand upon this world.
And I mentioned you're presenting this reading of Sweet Blood tomorrow at NACL, and there will be audience discussion. So what kind of conversation are you hoping to have to spark with the community? And how important is that feedback for you at this stage of development of Sweet Blood?
Yeah, I'm hoping to talk to the audience about what does it mean to be in community? What are our values? How do we fight for our values? How are we making sure that we're not leaving people behind in that fight? So I'm really interested in seeing how people engage in that discussion. And I just want to see how the story resonates with the audience. I think people might find, they might initially think that there is a distance of 1727, Jamaica, black women. This story does not relate to me. But I think after they see, we're presenting three scenes and just doing some community discussion, they'll realize that they have a lot more in common than they initially thought.
You're hoping that they'll engage with these ideas of the social and political impact of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Have you done something like this before where you have a play in development and then you're getting this audience feedback?
Yeah. My previous play, it's called Mud or When Things Get Messy and How We Live With It, is about my sister's bipolar disorder. So we did a reading of that, and then we had a talk back with mental health professionals, and then we had a writing workshop and talking about what does it mean to have bipolar disorder? How does it affect families? How do you write about these stories? So that was really amazing.
Brett, let's remind folks of the details, Sweet Blood tomorrow at NACL.
You can find out about it at nacl.org. The show starts at 7 o'clock, which is a little bit different than normal. That's our winter hours. We started a little bit earlier.
Because it feels like midnight at 4:30 here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And smart move. As usually happens at these work-in-progress sharings, afterwards, there's more informal discussion with the artists over some hot soup, homemade.
Oh, very good. Also, do you want to mention A Winter's Table coming up December 13th
yes,
at an ACL
indeed.
Before
yeah,
we go?
We have. So this is our last of the Deep Space residencies for the year, and then we'll be winding up the season on December 13th. That's a Friday. You can also find out about more about that at the website. We will be it's a celebration of a year of good work, of exploration and experimentation, and we're hoping that people will come and join us for food and drink and entertainment. And the centerpiece of this event is a mechanical table that artist inventor Dan Brinkerhoff has designed that slowly brings the food to the people down the center of the table. So there's a sort of sculptural artistic element at the center of this. Not to mention that the food is being provided by Henning Nordanger of Henning's Local.
Probably of Henning's Local here,
Julia's Local.
Leave it to NACL to make it a performance piece to have the food come to you. That's great. Before we go, Camille, you've been featured in so many notable venues, including NACL. What's next for you?
Well, in April, I will be in LA premiering a reading of my play 111 Orchestra, 111 Orchestra Place. It's a Detroit history play. And then you'll be able to see that play again as a reading in June in New York.
And we mentioned Racine, the director. Do you want to shout out your collaborators who are going to be with you tomorrow?
Racine Singletary, director of my dreams.
And you guys will be there tomorrow again. It's a play, new play, in development called Sweet Blood, delving into the lives of three black maroon Taino women in Jamaica in 1727. The reading is tomorrow. It's a work in progress, but the audience gets to discuss some of the major themes with the author and director, which is awesome. Camille Simone Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today. Brett Kaiser, thank you for joining us. There's more information today
Thanks,
at NACL.org. All right. Before we go, we want to just remind you about that winter storm warning. It's in effect for the region. National Weather Service in Binghamton issued the winter storm warning starting today at 4 through 4 tomorrow. Most of us could see 4 to 6 inches of snowfall after the rain transitions to snow. That's mainly overnight and into tomorrow morning, though those living in the northernmost and higher elevation towns could get 9 inches or more. And heads up, Northeast PA, totals of 12 to 18 inches possible in the highest elevations in western Wayne, eastern Lackawanna, eastern Susquehanna, and also then Delaware County here in New York. It's all dependent on not just where the bands of heavier snow spread, but also on the temperature. That temperature is going to bounce around the freezing mark. So still expect some snow and slow going late tonight and tomorrow. Already in the area, after school activities canceled at Liberty Central School District and Fallsburg Central School District. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hello, I'm Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. You know, jazz is a great improvised art form that started in America, spread around the world, and is still going strong. That's why every Saturday afternoon I bring you the best in current jazz. It's the newest, most interesting music you can hear anywhere. Join me for Living Jazz, noon to 2 Saturday, here on Radio Catskill.
The Radio Catskill Music Auction is live, online. Bid now on exclusive once-in-a-lifetime experiences like tickets to the New York Philharmonic, Gillian Welch and David Rawlings tickets, plus tickets to a Bethel Woods Pavilion concert and glamping experience. Don't miss your chance to get your hands on these incredible items and experiences. Place your bids now at WJFFradio.org before it's too late.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, as we mentioned, a winter storm warning in effect from 4 p.m. this afternoon through 4 p.m. tomorrow. Snow will be heavy at times under localized bands. Totals will be highly elevation dependent as well, a few inches or less in valley locations, with 5 to 12 inches above 1,500 feet and totals of 12 to 18 inches possible in the highest elevations of Northeast Pennsylvania. Travel could be very difficult, especially with the snowfall rates of 1 to 3 inches per hour in spots overnight. The hazardous conditions could impact the Friday commute, and heavy snowfall could bring down trees and wires due to the weight of the snow. If you must travel, keep an extra flashlight, food, and water in your vehicle in case of emergency. The latest road conditions for the state you're calling from can be obtained by calling 511, and an update on some delays and postponements for you. As we've mentioned, the Fallsburg Central School District and Liberty Schools Central School District activities are all canceled, including the Boys and Girls Club in Liberty and the Kids Club Childcare in Fallsburg. Looking ahead, we will see some temperatures tomorrow drop to 35 for the high, 32 is the low Friday night. For the weekend, 40 on Saturday, cloudy, a potential of a shower, 38 on Sunday, and cloudy and breezy.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank, still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9. Here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. On air, live streaming at WJFFradio.org. Ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill. Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.